Hi, and welcome to Common Denominator, straight up conversations with me, Moshe Popek. This week, space exploration. The space tourism sector is booming, but is that a good thing? And what does it mean for the future of space travel? Astrophysicist Dr. Erin McDonald, who also happens to be the chief science consultant for the Star Trek franchise, joins us now. Hi, Erin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about this.
So just going to the basics, so your expertise is in gravitational waves and general relativity. Right? For those of us who aren't astrophysicists, right? Let's go into like the basics.
Yeah, no worries. So general relativity is something that Einstein conceptualized about 100 years ago. It was this idea that, you know, our universe is a four-dimensional fabric. And that had been thought of by mathematicians and sort of theorized for a while. But what Einstein did is he asked the question, what happens to that fabric when we introduce mass? And that's sort of that classic image a lot of people see at science museums or on TV, where you have a bowling ball on a trampoline and it dips down the fabric of space-time. And then you can flick a marble around the bowling ball and it'll orbit. And the big thing was this solved why Mercury's orbit precesses. So it traces out a flower shape. So that's kind of the idea of general relativity. And then gravitational waves take that a step further and say, okay, well, what happens to that fabric when the bowling ball explodes or two bowling balls collide? And Einstein did the math and figured out that when that happens, it ripples space-time like a fabric, and they're sent out these waves. Now, Einstein said that they're so small, no one will ever detect them, but they're there. And then in 2015, we actually made that discovery. It was announced in 2016 that we detected gravitational waves for the first time. I left in 2014, so it's fine. I'm not bitter. They won a Nobel Prize, but whatever.
Wow. Well, no, it's super cool. So now you're full, well, we'll get into that later, but you're full time, I guess, working as a consultant on the Star Trek series. Is that?
That's correct. Yeah. I moved to LA about 5 years ago, and I've been working in the entertainment industry as a science consultant, and I've been working for the Star Trek franchise for a couple of years now, starting with Discovery Season 3.
Super, super cool.
What would you say
excites you the most? Obviously, all this buildup now about space, you know, space exploration, space travel. What would be the top things that excite you the most about it?
Well, I think the biggest thing that excites me is just seeing the excitement of the rest of the world. You know, space exploration is one of those cool things that manages to unify our entire globe. We are all just little travelers on the spaceship Earth. And so when we get to see people launch into space or make new discoveries, and it's something that continues to inspire, you know, the entire world. And so I think that that's really exciting. And, you know, the competition that we're seeing between different companies, that plays into that as well, you know, that it adds a level of excitement. We famously, you know, the space race in the 60s led to us landing on the moon. And I think a lot of people are just excited to see where this capitalism space race ends up taking us.
Right. And I know also, obviously, in order for, you know, whether it's Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Richard Branson, to invest all their company's dollars or in, you know, billions of dollars into this journey, I'm sure there's subsidies and I'm sure there's very or lower oversight. You know, so there's probably issues that go along with it, right? So there's always a cost and a price to pay.
Yeah. And that's kind of my biggest concern, to be perfectly honest. I think that that's something that we haven't figured out, how much oversight is needed. I think a great example of this is Elon Musk's, you know, space internet that he's putting up, the Starlink satellites.
Yeah.
And he's able to launch them on his own. And he's able to deploy them on his own. And there's no real regulation to stop him from literally littering our sky with these satellites. And that interferes with astronomy. It interferes with research. It makes our low Earth orbit more dangerous. There's something called the Kessler syndrome, That's basically you get our low Earth orbit so populated that if there's one collision, which again, we've, you know, just recently had a collision in space, it creates so much debris that then makes low Earth orbit dangerous to even pass through. So we run the risk of even limiting ourselves from being able to take off because low Earth orbit could potentially become so littered. So there's that lack of oversight. And when you have people who can basically do a whole chain from launching to deployment to operations that need to be regulated.
Right. And I think about like, who is it, who would even have jurisdiction? You know, each country has, right, is a sovereignty and each country has that ability. Like, who has the ability, if you're from where you're launching, whether it's, you know, here in Florida, Space Coast, or maybe in Texas, wherever it happens to be. So that I can understand that's the land, that's the jurisdiction. But when you go into outer space, who has, you know, the only broad jurisdiction would be like maybe the United Nations and certain pressures that way. But I just think, I don't know who would have jurisdiction of space.
Yeah. And in the past, it's typically been governments passing agreements. One recently was this agreement that anything that a government launched into space had to retain enough fuel to be able to basically send itself back down when it had reached end of life. And that was to prevent the space junk from going around. But those are government agreements. And as we move into a purely capitalistic, you know, space industry, then who's going to regulate them? And what jurisdiction do they really fall under and at what point? And, you know, there's so many internal agreements that they have now where the government is relying on these companies to help them with their government programs, that how much do you want to anger that relationship by trying to enforce some sort of jurisdiction? So it's really a brave new world and we're testing those waters and we'll see where that takes us.
And I think just for a layperson, so we talked about, you know, Elon Musk's company and Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos. So I know that they're doing different things with space travel. Maybe kind of give the audience a little idea with each company, what they're doing.
Yeah, I've thrown around the term low Earth orbit, and really you have Virgin Galactic and Richard Branson's and Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos. They're really looking into space tourism, and they are in like very, very low orbit. They basically go up to just about that line where we say you're in space, and it ranges from about like 70 to 100, you know, kilometers off the surface. But that is focused on tourism. So you take people up, they get to see the curvature of the Earth and get excited about that and have existential crises, as it were, and then they come back down. But SpaceX is really looking a bit further. And that's not to say that potentially Blue Origin or Virgin Galactic are going in those directions, but really what SpaceX is focused on is going beyond low Earth orbit and building rockets that can take us further out outside of low Earth orbit, beyond, potentially going to the moon, or again, Mars is sort of a goal of theirs. Yeah.
Right. So I saw that. Right. So, right. Cause I guess, Richard Branson went, he went on and so did Jeff Bezos, but Elon Musk didn't, because I guess he has that longer term, vision, and it's probably more complicated, right? Obviously, than to go to, you know, lower Earth orbit.
Yeah, that's exactly right. SpaceX, you know, they all have their capsules. And as you said, they've ridden on, you know, the other two have ridden on theirs. But what SpaceX capsule is, it goes further. It goes much higher up. Sure. And we say low Earth orbit, but that's still a few hundred kilometers. And the SpaceX capsule that's being used now is designed to send astronauts to the space station. So that's way further out. That's requiring, you know, much more danger. And so there's not really a need for Elon Musk to take that trip.
Sure.
Not necessarily.
What do you think space travel looks like in the next, let's say, 5 years, 10 years? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm trying to stay optimistic. A big event that, you know, happened was William Shatner going on the Blue Origin spacecraft. And one of the things that I said about this publicly is there's two hats that you wear with that. One is the image of James Tiberius Kirk going into space for the first time and what that means to people. But then the other image is a elder celebrity who's getting a ride to space with his billionaire buddy. And one is very optimistic, one is very cynical. And I think we're starting to lean toward the cynical as we have so much suffering here on Earth and so many people are struggling. To just see these billionaires take their buddies on joyrides is a little bit hard for people. So I think in the next 5 years, we may see a social shift against the space tourism until it becomes available for all, because that's so difficult. And that's what's always inspired people, because it was this idea that anyone could become an astronaut. They've had people, you know, of all types starting to go into space and go to the space station without needing a billionaire behind them. And so we're going to see that shift, but hopefully we'll see that pendulum swing backwards as we get more investment in this technology, hopefully becomes available to governments to use to be able to start sending people to the moon potentially, or, you know, even just expanding our International Space Station. So I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see ourselves expand into Earth's orbit more and become more comfortable going into space, hopefully. And then I would say in the next 10 to 20 years, that's when we're going to be looking at potentially the moon or Mars or any of those next steps.
Do you think that it might be, as Elon Musk sees it, kind of inhabit other, like to Mars, for example, will humans need to have an alternative over Earth? Do you think that that's
I love the image of a human stepping foot on Mars. I think that would be phenomenal. You know, Buzz Aldrin famously is like super angry, and I think rightfully so, that we went to the moon and came back and didn't establish a permanent presence there and get used to that. Now, the problem is Mars is very, very far away, and it is very dangerous to get there, and it's very dangerous once you get there. And I would say our resources are much better spent fixing the Earth situation than it is trying to spend that money and that danger and that risk to try to inhabit a world that is not habitable, like fully 100,000% not habitable.
Right. That's a fair point. Yeah. definitely a fair point. You may have one of the coolest jobs in the galaxy, and I want to ask you about it. But first, a reminder, this is Common Denominator. I'm Moshe Popak, and my guest today is astrophysicist Dr. Erin McDonald. If you're enjoying this episode, please subscribe on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts. And we'd be grateful for any 5-star ratings. Plus, we'd love to hear from you. If you have feedback about the show, send us your comments on Twitter at mpopak. Now, back to the show. I know earlier in the show we were talking about your really cool job as the science consultant for the Star Trek franchise. So tell us how you got into that and, you know, that kind of that journey.
Yeah, it's after I left academia, I really missed teaching. That was a big thing that that made it hard to leave. And so I began teaching at pop culture conventions. I would go to Comic-Cons and pop culture conventions and teach about the science using Star Trek or Star Wars or video games or, you know, pop culture that people are used to seeing, and then show what the science behind that is. And that really scratched that itch for me. And then when I moved out to Los Angeles, I kind of had this cadre behind me of, you know, a lot of these talks, and I'd been going all over the country for, you know, about 8 to 10 years at that point, giving these talks, and the Star Trek franchise was interested enough to bring me on to speak fan-facing at their official events. And so I did what was at the time Star Trek Las Vegas. And then I went on Star Trek The Cruise, and they were really well received. Star Trek fans have a long legacy, myself included, of people who appreciate that intersection of science and Star Trek. It's a long, long legacy for, you know, the last 55 years. It's inspired scientists, it's inspired technology. And so people love hearing about that. And then with the plethora of shows that they're starting for the Star Trek franchise, they brought me on, and a friend of mine, Professor Mohammed Noor from Duke University, they brought him on to do the biology. They brought me to do the astrophysics for season 3 of Star Trek Discovery. And then because I was in LA and they had a bunch of other shows being greenlit and moving forward, they thought it would be a valuable resource to have a scientist on retainer for all the shows to use as much or as little as they want. And it's been a great experience. I'm really happy. So I'm working on all 5 shows right now.
Wow.
And it's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. What is a typical day kind of on the set, set of Star Trek? What does that look like?
Well, given our current global pandemic, they have not invited the science consultant to set yet, which is unfortunate. They do a lot of filming up in Canada as well, so that makes it a little difficult. But that being said, typical day for me involves, usually I have a dump of scripts from the night before, after the rooms send them out to the studios, that I review any changes. I go through, takes a few hours to kind of go through all of the script revisions for all the shows, and send in, put any notes together. Then I go through any brand new scripts, ones I haven't seen before, which take a significant amount of time to read them from scratch, put my notes together. Typically, I'll hop into a room. I'm usually in a room twice a week, so the writers' rooms, and answering questions or just listening to where they're taking the story, chiming in as needed. And then I also have the odd post-production meeting. I work a lot with post-production graphics, particularly on Star Trek Discovery, where we're trying to get the science visuals accurate. So a lot of people, you know, will see a planetary system or a nebula or something like that. And that's something that I kind of double check with the post-production team to try to make something that looks realistic, but also looks cool and feeds the story as well.
Yeah, no, it seems definitely exciting. I you know, your accent obviously is American, but I know your background, you spent time, so I want to put a little emphasis on that. You spent time in the UK and got your PhD in Glasgow. So what made you kind of go on that journey? Because I always think, as an American, it's an interesting choice.
My grandfather was Scottish, came over from Scotland, and that was a place we used to go when I was a kid. And I always wanted to live there. I always felt, you know, that that's just part of where my soul is. I was always very happy and comfortable when I was in Scotland. When I was an undergraduate, I thought about doing a study abroad, but I wanted to do more than just a semester or a year even. And I had the opportunity, and it all just kind of worked out that the amount of research I'd done as an undergraduate made the graduate school process in the UK really appealing to me because it's much more of an apprenticeship. I'd done, you know, over 2.5 years of research. I'd actually published papers and had given presentations at conferences. And so the program in the UK is basically like, all right, there's your desk, come back in 4 years with a dissertation, good luck. as opposed to kind of the more slow burn, longer process that we have here in the United States. And so, it's 3 to 4 years, which is about where I landed, and went to the University of Glasgow. I loved it. It was fantastic. I ended up spending a couple more years over there and working as a researcher. And then the decision to leave academia was kind of what forced me to come back visa-wise. But yeah, I love it. And the great part is, you know, part of my soul will always be in Glasgow. And you know, you said I've got the American accent, but give me a day with Glaswegians and that accent will come back.
Yeah. No, because I think, you know, for Americans, I think it's well-rounded to go ahead and study abroad. And, you know, it's just a different, my wife's side's from, she spent 5 years in Moscow. So,
oh, wow.
So it's anytime that anybody can, but she grew up in Queens in New York. So
nice.
anybody that spends time abroad, I really like that. It's well-rounded in the mind. You know?
Yeah, I think the biggest lesson you learn is there's something very different from visiting a place to trying to stock your own kitchen in a foreign supermarket. Right. And even the UK, it's not that different, but try finding eggs in a British supermarket.
I want to really thank you, Erin. It's really been a pleasure. How could the audience find out more about you?
Yeah, thank you. I'm mostly on Twitter. It's at Dr. Erin Mack, D-R-E-R-I-N-M-A-C. I am currently on social media hiatus. because there's a lot of Star Trek coming out right now that I'm just going to let people step back and let people enjoy it. And yeah, I would encourage people to watch Star Trek Discovery. Star Trek Prodigy is a great entry point, particularly for families, that's starting to come out. And yeah, so check out Star Trek on Paramount Plus and find me on Twitter.
Cool. Thank you so much, Erin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Common Denominator podcast. Join us next week for another inspiring, impactful, and empowering conversation. To learn more about Moshe, head to moshepopak.com. If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share it. And we'd be grateful if you could rate, review, and subscribe to the show.